The speaker tonight I met about a month and a half ago at a meeting I attended, and we've been talking about having a speaker's meeting here at the club for quite some time. And so I heard him talk, I believe, two or three times. Finally, I asked him to speak here tonight. And I didn't really know how to even ask him, but he says, "Oh, yeah," he says, "I used to work the circuit." Well, I had to go ask what the circuit meant, but I guess there's speakers in a circuit. But anyway, I'm very proud to introduce Pat Patterson.
I said that it works as a circus, not the circus. I'm Pat, and I'm a real alcoholic. I have a speech impediment. I got this down in Bakersfield. My dentist got my last three teeth, and the police got the rest of them. So you have to pay close attention. Thank you for taking your hand off, Kevin. It says, in order to be a good speaker around these AA meetings, it says you have to have two qualifications. It says, number one, you have to have gray hair. Number two, you have to have hemorrhoids. It says the gray hair gives you marked distinction, and the hemorrhoids gives you a look of concern. It says, tell what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. But before I do that, I want to tell you about the most important men in this room to me tonight, is those that came and rode over with me. They're the guys that keep me kind of straightened out a little bit in my life. They're the guys I worked with, I lived with, and I've devoted my life to. The men, some of the men from the Salvation Army Alcoholic Rehabilitation Centers in the audience tonight, they told me to come over for two reasons, really. Said they didn't want me to take the rap by myself, and the other one was to keep me honest. I appreciate that. But to me, they're the most important people in the room tonight. I'll probably be talking more of them than I will you. What it used to be like, I was born in Texas. You can't tell that the way I talk. I was born in Texas between Moody and McGregor. A little place out there called Spring Valley Ranch, my grandfather owned. Now, you people don't know where Moody, Texas is, and McGregor probably, you know. It's right outside of Waco. I was kind of a shy kid. When I was small, I used to get behind grandma's apron, peek around at people when they business, you know, and so forth. And I know I've met some people that still do that, you know, that's still my age. You know, grab hold of mama's apron thing, peek out at the world. But I was raised on this ranch, and I was raised around a bunch of cowboys, and I had an identical twin brother. He's not with me anymore. He died in Korea. But he and I were raised up. I was the drunk of the bunch, you know. We did things the boys did back in them days, you know. Texans had a way of living probably that no other people have. You know, that boys will be boys stuff, you know. And you had to be tough and macho and all this bit. I started rolling cigarettes when I was 4.5 years old, you know. A little boy there in cowboy boots and big old hat on, you know, rolling them cigarettes was kind of cute, you know. And I've been smoking ever since. But looking back, the first time I began drinking was when I was around 11 years old. I went in town with the cowboys, and those bright lights in Waco hit me, and I ain't been the same since. And I started drinking at a very early age. Now I'm going to try to rush through this a little bit because I've got some important things to tell you about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't like those drunk logs too much, you know. I would rather see a good program than hear one. But I can tell you this much. I began drinking when I was 11 years old. And I became an expert at it. Between the age of 11 and 16, when I won service and got patriotic and went in service, I was arrested 56 times for public intoxication. I used to go in on the weekends with the cowboys, and I'd end up in jail with them, or they'd end up in jail with me. And then Grandpa would come and bail us out. So we'd go back to work. The first few times I got thrown in jail, they let me out right away. My dad happened to be a politician. Decided having a business. And I told that jailer the first time I got arrested, you better let me out of here. My daddy got your job for you in the first place, you know. So they let me out. And this happened a few times, you know, and finally they got tired of it and they called my grandfather up and told him what had happened. And he said, well, just keep him overnight and, you know, he'll be all right the next day. He let him out the next day. And that's the way it continued. I did become an embarrassment to my family. I told you I got real patriotic and going to service. Actually, what happened was I was so embarrassed, such embarrassment to my family, by the time I got 16 years old, I stood in front of the judge in Gatesville there, and he gave me a choice. I'm always getting choices. I'm still getting choices. He said, you either go in the service or you go into that reformatory over here. That's where the reformatory was at, over Gatesville. Well, I heard about that reformatory in Gatesville. They had an old boy there named Mr. Crawley. But that wasn't his real name. He was called a Texas boy beater. And I didn't want any part of him. So I got real patriotic and I joined the Navy. I got in the Navy, and it was just the thing for me at that time. This was back in 1945. Of course, I don't look that old. But it was a license for me to drink. And I did. And I got promotions from it. I went in the Navy in 45 and went through some training in Little Creek, Virginia. And I was an underwater demolition. And we partied. And we had a good time. We was tough and we was macho, you know, that type of thing. You know, I'm reflecting here just a while back, the first time I think in my life that I might have had an alcoholic problem was when I was in the Navy. I thought back about it. You see, one time we had a day off from UDT training. And I was taking it easy, and that afternoon I went over to the canteen over there where they served the beer, you know, so forth, 10 cents a can. And went in that air-conditioned canteen and started drinking, you know. And stayed there for quite some time till that evening. And I came out of the canteen and that old hot sun hit me in Virginia there, you know, and I went into a blackout. And when I came to, I was standing in front of the officer's Dave's headquarters there, and I was peeing on his leg. I thought at that time I just might have some problem with my grandpa. But it wasn't until years later that I realized it. I was no saint. I went through this deal, and and went through this Korean deal, so forth. And I was present when my brother got killed. My twin brother and I were real close, you know, real, real close. The only difference you could tell between he and I was that he was left-handed and I was right-handed. That's the only difference you can tell. I got out of service in 1952. And I didn't go home. You see, when I was in service, I used to ride home and tell them, well, I'm going to come home on leave. And I was still in birth and two, and they didn't want me to come home on leave. I said, please send me some money, you know. And sure enough, that old man of mine sent me enough money, and he knew if it was enough, I wouldn't come home, I'd go get drunk someplace, which I did. And so I didn't stay at home. I went up to this town up north here in the state of Washington. I stayed up there and I got out of service. I drove a truck for a little while, and then that interfered with the drinking, so I quit driving the truck and continued drinking. And what happened was, I'd been out of service just a few short months. I went into the bank one morning, cash a check, and being the drunk that I was, this lady had the audacity to tell me that my checking account had been overdrawn again. And I got real indignant and cussed her out, the bank out, and told somebody I ought to rob that damn thing and left. I went down to one of my favorite water holes I drank at, cashed a check down there, figured I'd make it good, you know. And continued to start drinking, continued drinking. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in the morning in jail again. You know, I was famous for getting in jail again. And I wanted to pay my fine, get out of there, I wanted to drink. And they told me, you're not in for that. And then they told me what happened. They said, I went into that bank that afternoon and proceeded to rob that bank. And in the process, I killed a bank guard. And so, I had to go to court on this. Not even knowing it, to this day, and this is the truth, to this day I do not remember robbing that bank. Directly from the use of alcohol. As an end result of robbing this bank, I received life for killing the bank guard and 15 for robbing the bank. In other words, I had to die first and do 15 more before I could get out. They sent me down to an island in San Francisco Bay for a while. I won't talk about that too much. It was an experience. And I stayed down there until 1957. And then in 57, they sent me up there to McNeil Island, Washington. And I hung around there for about a year to 58, November 58, in fact. And during that year, you know, it was different from Alcatraz. You had privileges there you didn't have where I had been before, you know. You could go to the commissary. And the first chance I got to go to the commissary, I went down there and bought 6 boxes of candy. Now, I don't eat candy. It was just a privilege of being able to buy something. I carried these 6 boxes of candy down Carter with me. Pat, want the candy man, want the candy, you know, grinning like he had good sense. Because it was just a privilege to do this. You see, 2.5 years that time now, I was welded in the cell. But anyway, it was just a privilege. And they had what they call, if you want anything, if anybody thinks you can't get nothing to drink in prison, you're nuts. You know, if you don't think you can't get any dope in prison, they say if you want some real good stuff, go to Leavenworth. You know? Did you know I had three guards bringing in whiskey for me? It cost me $15 a bottle. They call them fists now. $15 a jug. I'd buy a jug of whiskey. I was sneaky that way. I'd squat the top off of it. I'd pour half of it out into another jug. I'd pour this full of water. Leave the top back on the shelf for what I paid for it. And this one over here, that with the good stuff, was mine. It was mine. I could drink that, you know. And that's the way I did. Ran a little gambling there too and so forth, but that's immaterial. It's what happened after that. You see, McNeil, after I'd been there about a year and so forth, they had put me in a 10-man cell. There was guys from all walks of life in there, you know. And I'm laying on my bed one night in November '58. I'm laying on my bed and I'm feeling sorry for myself, my situation in life and so forth. And I got to looking around the cell and I didn't want to take my own inventory, so I began taking the inventory of the guys in my cell, their situation in life. The day before, we just got a guy in there that was 20 years old. And he had 20 years of bank robbery. He was so young that he was going to have to move him out to another institution, which he did. And also in that cell, we had an old man in there over 65 years old doing 25 years on a mandatory post office job, which meant no parole and he'd never get out and he would die there, which he did. I got to thinking about these two guys. You know, who failed this young man? You know, his parents, his school, so-called society, you know, to get this kid in the situation he was at. And then I got to think about that old man. Now, that old man is going to die here. We know it, he knows it, and so forth. And then in retrospect, I looked at me, I think, for the first time in my life. I didn't like what I saw. I was thinking, you got a good chance of dying like that old man there. And at that time, I had the thought that if I have to die in here, I don't want to die the way I am. And I reflected back and knew that every time I had got into problems or got into trouble was from the use of alcohol. We had an AA program there. They met on Wednesday night, and then they had outside people on Sunday come in. Wednesday night was a discussion group, and the outsiders brought a meeting over, you know, and they usually talked. I decided to go. They opened up the cell on Wednesday night, and I snuck out the cell, down the stairs, you know, and went down the corridor to the conference room where these discussion groups were going on. And I looked both ways before I went in the door. I didn't want any of my friends to see me going that damn day AA meeting. That was almost bad going to church, and I never did go to church since John. But I'll get a name. But I went in, I sat on the back row and looked around, knew everybody in there. They knew me. I sat on the back row and the chairman had picked a topic for discussion. And the topic for discussion that night was honesty. And here was a whole room full of convicts getting up behind the podium telling me honesty is getting me in this program. There's a line about the back of there. talking about something else. Something I didn't know anything about. They were talking about self-life that we get in this program, you know. But Sherman O'Lee on, he says, keep an open mind, keep coming back. He says, we've got a group of outside people coming in Sunday, and you might hear something to do you some good. And so I did. I filled up Sunday up in the education department, a bigger place up there. And sure enough, you hear come these little boys from open sin. They trooped in here and they had them $300 suits on and 42 cents in their pocket, you know, and looking real good and clean, sober. And that didn't impress me as much, you know, as I was listening that day for a change. I was listening to it. And old boy read a portion of the fifth chapter at this meeting. How it works. You know, like rarely haven't seen a person fail to thoroughly follow their path. And then talks about being honest. And gives you these 12 steps. If you try to practice these, you might learn how to live sober. Well, that didn't impress me too much, but when they got down that one little sentence that said, we're not saints, then I knew I was in the right place. Thank God we're not saints. You know. And they told me when I got in AA, they said, you got to get a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. And so I looked at them old boys over that's coming over, you know, and I sing this one old thing, you know, looked like he'd been around a while and he talked a little bit pretty good, you know. So I got him over in the corner when he visited on one Sunday, you know, and I said, Dick, would you be my sponsor? He looked at me and said, I've heard about you, boy. He said, I don't know whether I want to sponsor you or not. I said, well, he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'll be your temporary sponsor. He said, because I might want to fire you and you might want to fire me. He said, but we're going to do it my way. This program, Alcoholics Anonymous, Pat, he said, we're going to do it my way. And I says, what's your way, Jim? He says, it's in that big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you start on page one, you ain't smart enough to start any place else. And you read that book and you take these steps. And I'll guide you through them. He said, now step one, he said, I want you to study that. He says, I'll be back next Sunday to see you. You stay here and I'll be back next Sunday. You know, he was a mean old son of a bitch. I hate his guts. I hated him for a long time. You know why I hated this old boy? Because he told me the truth and I wasn't used to it. He told me the truth. We started going through these steps together and I'll never forget it, you know. I got into step four where you write all this, he said, write it out like they suggest, you know. I said, how do that? He said, well, you put all your liabilities on one side and all your assets on the other. I said, all right. So I started writing. He said, now you stay here. He said, I'll be back next Sunday. And so we come back next Sunday. And I'm writing on this thing, you know. And he said, what you got wrong? I showed him. I had a list of defects of character that long, you know. He said, ain't nothing on my asset side, Pat. He said, there just might be something good about you you can put up there. He said, I want something written up there. He said, you stay here and I'll come back next Sunday. So sure enough, he come back next Sunday. He said, did you have anything written down on that asset side? I looked at him and grinned. I said, I sure do. He said, let me see it. You know what I'd written, being the convict I was? I ain't never snitched on anybody. I Well, old Grump, he said, "You're sober today, ain't you?" I said, "Yeah," he said, "write that down." I said, I asked old Dick, I said, "Old Grumpy," I said, "you anything else all right down there?" He said, "No, you better give it a rest. You might think of something next Sunday." So let's continue. I got interested in alcoholism, alcoholics. And you know, I'd only been to the ninth grade when I went into the service. And I didn't have any school to speak of. So I started going to school. I got a GED. And did you know I was so smart I got a 4.0 on it? I didn't know this. I didn't know I was smart, see? And I continued an education throughout the time in prison. You know, I did 29 years, so I'm getting on. But I continued my education. And by the end of my sentence, I had some diplomas on the wall. I have a major in business administration, minor sociology, and I have an associate degree in substance abuse. I used to sit there in my cell, look at them diplomas, and say, "Gosh, you're smart, ain't you?" I've been in AA a short time, and they asked me to get up and say something. I always got up, somebody up, say something for 5 minutes before the them guys from the outside talk. And they asked me to get up one time, and I didn't know. My sponsor told me I had to, old Grumpy. So I got up and I said, "The only thing I told him my name, I was an alcoholic. I said, "The only thing I can tell you folks here," I said, "old Leon, our chairman over here, he's asked who's read the big book or who's read it, you know." I said, "Them old boys held up their hand, you know, and I held up mine too. I didn't want to be left out." And I said, "But actually," I said, "I haven't read that big book." I said, "But I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to start reading that big book after this meeting." And sure enough, after that meeting, I went up there and stole one of them books and read it. Best thing I ever did. You know? And talk about honesty. You know, them 90-day chips, got a white one, a blue one, and a red one. I want one of them red chips. 90 days, you know. I want one so bad, and I ain't even learned to whiten yet. You know, but I want one of them red ones. And so I called for a break one time. I snuck up there and stole one of them. And I took it back the next week and told them, you know, what had happened. And tried to get honest. You know, it's been a struggle. Still is sometimes. You know, it's still a struggle. But I went and told them, you know, and then when I finally got that 90 days, it broke the house down. You see, I found something Alcoholics Anonymous I've never found before. When I took step two, I found a God in AA that I can understand and that can understand me. My God, I didn't believe in God, really, after some things I'd put myself through, you know. But old Murphy said I had to find a God. And he said, "Find one." And this is the way I did it. Maybe it's a good suggestion for somebody here who's having difficulty trying to find a God. I kept going to these meetings, looking around, seeing this progress being made in these old things of life, seeing a miracle being performed. And pretended that there must be some higher power doing this for them, because I knew damn well they couldn't do it for themselves. A little later I came to believe, like those first three steps. I came to believe. Taking these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has been the most important thing in my life. Well, kid, if I got into step five, you know, that was a doozy. Admit to God, yourself, another human being, the exact nature of your own. I didn't trust anybody in that penitentiary, you know, even myself. I got to thinking. I said, well, let me see who I'm going to do this with. We had a Catholic chaplain there. Now, I'm not a religious person, thank God. But we had a Catholic chaplain there. And I said, well, I'll take it to that old boy, you know, because I understand back in my mind someplace that these Catholic priests keep things to themselves, you know, if you tell them anything. And so I explained to the chaplain, Father Premier, I said, this is what I want to do. I'm going to take this step, and he understood what it was about. And so he put me on call out. He figured he put me on call out for 3 days. It may take more than that. But he put me on call out, and we got up to his office, and we got all ready to take this fifth step, and I brought all these notes with me with my liabilities and assets on it, you know. And we got all ready, and still back in my mind, I was a little apprehensive about telling someone these things. And so I thought I'd test the poor old priest out. I looked at him, and I told him one of the damnest things that I ever did in my life, which was terrible. And I sat back, I looked at him, and I said, well, what do you think of that, Father? He said, well, you dirty son of a bitch. I just laughed, and then we understood each other, and I was able to do this. And you know, something happened. After I took that fifth step, that's very important. I had to go back to step three, where I made the decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him. But it wasn't until I got all that garbage out, or I let some of this good stuff come in, that I began to understand God, that I found in AA. I got interested in 1961, me and another old boy. He's dead now. Got interested in alcoholism, and we set up a program in McNeil Island. It was a 10-day program for new men coming in that might have an alcoholic problem. You know, they're caseworkers, or they call them parole officers. So the caseworkers would get a guy in and think might be have an alcoholic problem. They'd run him through our 10-day program. We showed videotapes and gave them lectures, and the last day of the 10 days we'd give them the resources they used while he was in the penitentiary. And also, if they were short time, the resources they could use when they got out to help them with their alcohol problems, you know. And it was very successful. In fact, I went from one federal penitentiary to the other setting up these programs. And I really enjoyed it. But I'm going to tell you something. I had a spiritual experience the second year I was in AA. My first, you know, my spiritual experiences, they call them awakenings again, but my spiritual experiences seem to always happen through other people. I've been in AA a couple of years, and it came up December, and we had our Christmas party. And it was at nighttime, and each one of us members of AA were allowed to invite some other guy from inside the population to go with us that wasn't in AA. And I asked this old man if he'd like to go. I'd known him down south on that other island, you know, and he said he sure would like to. So that night, they had the Christmas party, and my old friend Doc Hink was talking. He was important. But that night, we had to go outside the electric gates and down the Sallyport and around the building. And all them guys left first, and me and this old man went out last, you know. And I'm about halfway down that ramp, this old man froze. Out in the distance, it was a clear, beautiful night. The moon was out, not the distance you said, Mount Rainier or whatever it is, you know, and it was beautiful, beautiful sight. So old man froze and I hollered at him, come on, old man, we can't keep this line up, you know. So he come on up. I said, what the hell am I to you, Ray? He said, Pat, he said, do you know this is the first time in over 25 years I've been outside at night? I knew what he meant. Many, many nights, many years since I've been outside at night. No. And for me, I'll never forget this. So when he died, now he died in 1979. He was public enemy number one at one time. He was one that Pat Boyko, Hoover was dead 2 years before they let him out. Ray Carpenter. So I transferred to Leavenworth in 1960-something, 69, something like that. Yeah, and worked on this program there and set that program up there. And then I went to Lewisburg, set up there. I went to Atlanta, set up there, and then sent me back to Leavenworth. In 1971, they opened up a correctional institution down in Texas, Fort Worth, Texas. It used to be a naval mental hospital. I'd sit right at home there. They sent me and a couple of little boys down there as counselors, alcoholism counselors, from Leavenworth. And old Gypsy and I went down together, and old Jim, he left before we did, old Jim Hickson. He was one of them all Barker gang. But he went down before we did. And Gypsy and I went down on a prison bus, that federal bus, you know, and stopped there to police the country before we got down there. And Gypsy and I were the only two getting off there. Well, come to find out that Fort Worth Correctional Institution was co-education. I mean, they had the girls doing time there, you know. And so they stopped and they opened the gate and they had a guy meet us at the gate. This is minimum custody gone. And Gypsy and I had little bags with us and we were getting off, you know. And about that time, this little red-headed girl walked by the gate there and she had on what they call in those days hot pants. And they was hot. Gypsy was getting off first and I was right behind him and I fell on top of him. We both went to the ground. We didn't care where we landed because we had our eyes on the blues on that girl. We hadn't seen anything like that long time. We brushed herself off and got up, you know, and so forth. And Gypsy turned to me and he said, Pat, he said, that gal there reminds me of our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, what do you mean? He said, she's what is it? Oh, she's self-supporting to her own contribution. And she was. I went in there as coordinator for the alcoholism program. I was counseling too, but they made me coordinator for it. And did you know what they did? This old convict had been locked behind the wall so long, the only mail I ever got over them years was a Christmas card from the chaplain's office. You know what they did to me down there? Made the coordinator for the alcoholic program there. But the Alliance office of the office already talked between AA groups and all this bit. And I was there 2 weeks and I was running around the staff car in town all this bit, you know, rubbing shoulders, making talks here and there. I talked to Lions Club and every place else, you know. And the dumbest talk I ever gave was, I happen to think this because I heard those news the other day, here,
The chief police convention was down there in 1975. And guess who the main speaker was? Man, did I enjoy that. I thought it started out right. You know, I told them the jokes. I thought they appreciated it. You know, about the little boy walking down the street and got this bitch dog falling. And the police stops and says, little boy, says, dog me. He looked down and said, no, officer, she's in the shade. He said, no, funny, he said, you don't understand. He said, I mean, the dog eat bread. He said, why? I just fed her this morning. He said, no, kid. He said, you don't give me it all. He said, I mean, the dog needs leave. Oh, he said, go ahead. I always want the police, don't you? Before I got there, I was in Kansas City giving a talk for what the new thing they had put in prison called H&I. You know, didn't have H&I for a long time. They just had people coming in carrying missiles. And so they pulled me out of that and where it took me over to Kansas City to give this talk. I talked for a talk, which they told me that I probably knew more about it than they did. And so I did. I gave a talk there. At this convention, I met the main speaker. He don't mind me breaking his anonymity either. Name's Harold Hughes. He was a retired senator from the state of Iowa. And he got interested in me. And in 1971, when I got down to correctional institution, I started working with my boys down there, you know. He and some other people, the only way I could get out was I had to be pardoned to clemency of some kind. And so him and some other people had me fill out the papers and so forth, and they put recommendation books and so forth, you know, and they sent it in. And they worked on this. In 71, they started this in 71. And in 1979, I received a pardon from that peanut farmer. You know, that's the part. I vote for him today if you run. But I'm not And actually, I didn't get cut actually loose till 81. But what they did, when I got that, they sent me back to Leavenworth. And they sent me to Des Moines, Iowa, where this old boy was at. And I ran a work release program for federal prisoners. That's where they get short, and they come in, and they spend 90 days to 6 months, you know, and they go out and get a job and learn how to cross on the green light or whatever's happening. And I helped run that as a counselor, you know. And I worked at that for about 6 months. And then I received a opportunity to get my certification in alcoholism from Veterans Administration Hospital, 79. So in October 79, I transferred, went to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and went through that program, you know, and got the certification for that in alcoholism counseling. And then I came back to Des Moines. And I went back to work on the same job, but I wasn't there too long. I had another opportunity, and that was at Broad Arms Medical Center. And I went over there, I worked in their detox. These guys, police would bring in drunk and so forth, you know. And I worked there and I became a certified detox technician. I'd get certified all over the place. And I had to add too, you know. I wanted to catch all phases of this for the work I really wanted to do. You know. And so the funding ran out on that job in 82, and I decided I'd head for California. I'd heard a friend of mine told me of an opportunity out in California, you know, which didn't work out, but I headed to California. I went to Texas to see if any of my old friends was around. They was all dead, you know. And I visited my mother and father's grave and so forth. And then I headed out and I ended up in Bakersfield. And I was pretty near broke by the time I got to Bakersfield. And this was in 82, and I went into the Salvation Army, ARC. Told them I just got out of penitentiary after a number of years and so forth. Trying to get together where I get a job and so forth. And so they said, all right. I said, come on into our program here. And so in 82, I went into their program. And started attending AA meetings and so forth. And they had what they call in the Salvation Army beneficiary. That's $1 a day the first week, you know, and then $1 the next week, you earn up to $19 in one canteen jar. Here it's $19 and six canteen jars. No, I don't know what this is. But I was a beneficiary for a little over 3 years. Because it satisfied my needs and I could do the things I really wanted to. See, money wasn't the same, you know. You see, I'd met my God, the God you found in AA. It's working through people. And I had an opportunity to do this. And so I worked with people since age two to the present day. I worked on a couple of nights, they don't know. You know what I did? I told them old boys when we were coming over here, you know, they volunteered to come over. See? Ride the van over here. You know, it's a program of tractor rather than promotion. And I said, I think you're gonna have go-go girls over there. But they showed up anyway. But anyway, I began working there, and I worked all the jobs I had in Salvation Army, house man and all this bit, and I even counseled in between counselors they had there, couldn't hire one. And so a year before I came up here to Portland, I quit that job I had with the Salvation Army when I got a job. And you know what it was? Helped start up a detox. They didn't have a detox in Kern County, the richest county in the state, and they hadn't got a detox. I helped start up one of those. And that went for about a year and then ran out of money. I got to thinking, what'll I do, you know? And I thought I'd come up here. The fellow that gave me a greater understanding of God, his understanding, was head of the ARC up here, and I thought I'd come up here, you know, Major Randall. So I came up here, you know. And today I'm a beneficiary again. That's okay. I'm doing the things that I want to do. Okay. I'm going to meetings. I'm reading the big book and I'm not taking a drink. Isn't that something? Gee, that's something. You know, and the program has to be something for me. You know, it has to be. The simplicity of the program is what saved our butt. I look in each and every person I work with and I see sober, drunk, or indifferent, you know. And I see God. You see, God to me, God's a white man, God's a black man, God's a red man, and my God ain't afraid. And I stole that from old Sonny Wells down in Texas. old red-headed black guy that had freckles. He said one day that he looked at his mother, he looked at his sister, he looked at his brother, and he said each one of them he looked at, they were blacker and blacker, you know. And he got a scratch his head when the hell he got that red hair and freckles. Sonny Wells opened up a program that Chester's familiar with. In fact, he and Chester opened it up, I think. It's called New Directions down in Texas. It's the rehabilitation of halfway houses for the ex-convicts. And it is successful. You know, having a part in something like that is very gratifying. I have a need today, I think that's the reason I'm still around. I have a need to work with people. Am I tired of people? You know? I have a real need for it. When that need's gone, I'm gone. You know, but don't want to rush it. Tomorrow's Easter. I got to think about that. Years ago, about 2000, there was a carpenter. And he made a statement, "Come unto me, all ye that are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." He made the same statement to me. I came to believe. God bless every one of you. Thank you for your attention. You know, I was giving this talk a long time ago for a bunch of people, and they sat back there with their mouth open about 3/4 way through the talk. You know, I said, "Man, I'm really getting to these people." And all of a sudden, they all yawned at one time. But I promise I'll try to keep this short as possible. But I tell you what, I don't know how long I'll be here. I don't know if I'm going back down here or not. You know, I may stay up here for a while. Look around and see what you got, you know. The guy at my talents, you know. But really, you know, whatever grade. You see, faith is a substance of things hoped for and evidence of things. And I have a faith today that I've never had before. I have a belief today that I've never had before. I'm going to leave you with a little quotation I heard years ago. My grandfather used to say, you know, it's kind of like an Irish quote. He said, "May you be in heaven 30 minutes before the devil announces you die." And may the devil not find out you've died. You see, we have a purpose for living. I think the loudest purpose for living for a convict in the penitentiary to get out is just for the sake of getting out. I think he has to have more purpose than that. They say it takes a sick alcoholic to understand the well alcoholic, or the well alcoholic to understand the sick alcoholic. I take one step further. It takes the sober ex-convict alcoholic to really understand those that are still sick and in prison. And that's where I'm going at. A guy said, "Do you mean you run around and tell people you're an ex-convict?" I said, "Well, that was my ambition to become an ex-convict." Man, I tell you something, by the grace of God, I am. And I know it. You see, Carter didn't sign that pardon. He just helped me. God did
with people just like you in these rooms, you know? You see, I could never do anything. I still can't do anything. We can do what I cannot. Takes a whole bunch of us together. Get that strength, you know. In closing, I want to close with this. It's a story I heard, and some of you probably have heard. But every once in a while, even outside, I forget a little bit and don't have gratitude I should have. It's about this young guy that his ambition in life was to grow up and raise a family, have a couple of kids and so forth, get a good job, get a good education. He did this. He got married and had a couple of kids and he worked and everything. And one day while he was at the office, his house caught fire and it burnt down. And he lost his family. And he grieved about this and grieved about this for a long time. And finally he figured, well, I just can't keep on grieving like this. I have to do something. I have to continue. So he decided he'd try again. And he prospered a little bit more, got another house, got another wife, a couple more kids, you know. And one day on vacation, they was out on their boat on the lake. And a storm came up and the boat capsized. And he was on one to make it shore. And he crawled up on that shore and he looked up towards heaven. And he said, God, he said, why me? And this cloud broke open, and this voice come down. Says, I don't know, Pat, there's something about you just pisses me off. We're not saints. We just strive towards spiritual perfection. You know, we strive in that area. I'm going to meet you people as I because you wrote a happy destiny around here, you know? And I tell you something about Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt it when I came in this door tonight, you know? There's just no strangers here, you know? You're all with me, you know? And God's in the name, thank you.